suis venu vous parler d'Europe.
Together, we can achieve incredible things.
Europa skal stå stærkere i vores egen ret.
Europa ist unsere Zukunft.
Du lytter til Altinget taler om Europa med din vært Thomas Lauritzen.
We didn't believe that it will happen. And it actually it was a surprise on the 24th of February, just because actually, and we were telling it to Putin directly, that actually it will be rather the most stupid things to do to attack Ukraine.
Helt indtil selve dagen for Ruslands invasion af Ukraine i februar sidste år, troede Frankrig simpelthen ikke på, at Putin ville gøre noget så dumt. Sådan sagde den franske ambassadør Christophe Parisot under en debat på folkemødet i juni. Det her er nummer to debat fra Bornholm, som jeg gerne vil spille for dig her i vores lille serie af særlige sommerudgaver af podcasten. Den her debat handler også meget om Ukraine, Rusland og sikkerhed i en verden i oprør. Men hvor du i sidste uge kunne høre en række EU-parlamentarikere diskutere krigens konsekvenser, ja, så er det denne gang især diplomaterne, der kommer til orde. Udover franskmanden Parisot, så er USA's ambassadør Alan Leventhal også med, og udover Pension Danmarks direktør Torben Møger Pedersen tæller panelet Udenrigsministeriets tidligere departementschef Ulrik Vestergaard Knudsen, som i dag er vicegeneralsekretær i OECD. Han siger blandt andet sådan her:
Had it not been for US leadership when it comes to defending democracy, freedom, rule of law against Russian aggression in Ukraine, I don't think Europe is politically mature enough yet to have handled this on our own, even though this is a crisis on our own soil.
Velkommen til den her særudgave af Altingets europæiske podcast, hvor vi igen tager dig med til folkemødet på Bornholm. Debatten her er modereret af journalisten Josefine Kofod fra TV2 News. Og den starter med, at den amerikanske ambassadør Alan Leventhal fortæller, at USA allerede i efteråret 2021, i modsætning til Frankrig, var overbevist om, at Rusland ville invadere Ukraine.
Well, the United States had very clear intelligence in the fall of 21 that Russia intended to invade Ukraine. And the Biden administration made a decision to keep all of our allies fully informed. Not many nations thought it would happen. Even Ukraine was skeptical that it would happen. And of course, then the invasion occurred. But as a result of keeping our NATO partners informed, sanctions would put in place it with unprecedented speed. And we've seen since the war began, NATO, which is the most powerful alliance in the military alliance in the history of the world. For close to three quarters of a century, it has protected a billion people. That alliance, NATO, has only gotten stronger. So we had quite a different view. We were convinced this would happen. We brought our NATO allies up to date. When it did happen, I think everyone was positioned to act very quickly, and NATO is stronger today, and with the addition of Finland, and hopefully soon to follow with Sweden.
Ambassador Parisot, I'm curious to France being such a huge nation in Europe, speaking with such a loud, often clear voice, in the days before the invasion, how was France preparing? Were you, as the Americans, certain this was going to happen? Or was it a shock for you and for Europe?
I think, and we had the same intelligence, and we were sharing this intelligence. The difference is just like we didn't believe that it will happen. And it was a surprise on the 24th of February, just because actually, and we were telling it to Putin directly, that actually it will be rather the most stupid things to do to attack Ukraine. So we didn't really believe that it could happen. But I think it's because we forget that maybe some of the people had a different rationale than we have. And but I think despite this, we were quite conscious that we were already kind of a world that changed. I usually say, and sorry for the people who attend some other debates, but there were no more distinctions between hard and soft power. Everything was hard power or has become hard power. It means like you have more and more competition in all fields, be it like economy, be it like political, be it security, energy, anything. So, and even culture. So we could feel this. And we also could feel that actually there were some powers trying to overturn the international order based on institution and also based on values and norms. That was actually the things. But we couldn't actually believe it, that he will do it. Because what he succeeded to do is to revive NATO, something. He got like basically everyone supporting Ukraine. He didn't get Ukraine, united Ukraine. And come on, I mean, that's, and he got like 11th or 10th packet of sanctions against Russia. That's rather stupid to do, but he still did it.
And that leads me to you, Ulrich, because from an economics point of view, well, if we then look at, let's say, February 24th, how concerned were you about the Western world's economy when you woke up that morning to the news?
Well, I'd say going one day back, the 23rd of February, I think was the last day of the best years of your lives. I'm sorry not to be too optimistic, but preceding that was 33 years of hope, stability, peace in Europe, growth. And now suddenly we woke up the 24th of February. Now we suddenly had fear. We had instability. We had war in Europe for the first time on that scale, at least, in almost 80 years. And of course, my immediate concern was also the fact that we had war and we knew we were going to have an economic war now also with Russia. But what slowly sort of dawned, I think, on everyone was that this would probably also now bring to the forefront the geopolitical friction that we've seen between especially the US and China, but basically between the West and autocracies for about 5 years. We'd just been a little bit slower in Europe to wake up to it, perhaps. And perhaps also the US had more at stake in many ways. So that is actually, for me, perhaps the biggest, as an economist, the biggest lingering concern after the 24th of February. It is that we've now entered the era of geopolitics. We came from the era of globalization. And it means that every major decision taken in Washington, in Paris, in Copenhagen, in Brussels, and in Beijing, every major decision taken over the last 18 months, when you had just the slightest trade-off between economics and politics, between globalization, welfare, competition on the one hand, and geopolitical national security concerns on the other, every single time from now on, geopolitics will win the day. So into an area with less globalization, more geopolitics, more uncertainty.
Now, Torben, I'm curious because I think most of us remember February 24th, and I'm sure you do too. And from an investor point of view, I mean, one of the Denmark's largest investors, you hold our retirement in your hands. How concerned were you? I mean, we hear Ulrich, the OECD, being concerned. How concerned were you on behalf of the investments?
Well, actually, in the months before the invasion, we actually listened to the intelligence reports from both US and UK. And during the month of January last year, we sold out all our Russian assets, bonds and equities. So when the invasion went up, we had zero positions in Russia, luckily. But in spite of that, it was also a shock for us, because although we, from a risk perspective, did what I just mentioned, we didn't expect such a dramatic incident to take place, in spite of all the intelligence reports. And I fully agree with Ulrich that this is there's a day before and a day after the invasion. And I've said in some other contexts that I think when we will rewrite the history books, 2022 will be put in line with 1940, 1939, 1989, There's a time before and after.
Ambassador Leventhal, when you hear Ulrich, for example, being a bit pessimistic about the future and how geopolitics are going to influence every single part of policy that comes out from the U.S. now. First of all, of course, do you agree with the analysis and how, if you were to exemplify the consequences on U.S. soil, how has it has influenced the way you think politics?
So the U.S. approach is to work closely through our allies. You know, I hear the comments sometimes the U.S. has had its focus on China and Asia, and its attention is going to be taken away from Europe. Well, the fact is, we can do more than one thing at a time. And when you think about the support of the U.S. of Ukraine, we're talking $60 billion of support, military support, humanitarian support, economic support. We're talking, and of course, Denmark has been such a tremendous supporter in the top five in terms of military support. And on top of that, you look at the humanitarian and also the rebuilding work that's being planned in terms of Mykolaiv. So we're working closely through our allies. We do have a challenge with China. It's been there. It's not new because of the war in Ukraine. And our policy there is not to decouple, but it's to de-risk. You know, we have to be mindful of our supply chains. We have to be mindful of our technology and what could affect our security. But we also need to engage in China.
And I promise you, we are going to talk about China in just a minute. We will, but I do have a question for you, Ambassador Parisot, because your President Macron was actually in the beginning trying to take on the position of kind of a negotiator, trying to make Russia get back to their senses and trying to figure out, is there a way to get peace sooner than later? It seems you shifted the strategy within the last half a year. Do you have a sense of where Russia is moving toward, what Russia is moving towards? Has Macron, who was actually the one who was able to reach out, is that gone? Because I think we were kind of hoping that maybe France would be the country that could actually negotiate.
In your question, I would just correct it to just like we tried till the 24th of February, and then after the 24th of February, we didn't try it at all. But I think what President Macron tried is till the last moment to just tell the right signal to Putin and says, don't do it, because if you do this, there will be a huge consequence actually for you. So, but I think it gives a wrong impression that we were trying actually even in the first months of the conflict to just kind of find a way of negotiating things. I think we've been very clear from the start that the only strategy that we do have, and that's the same thing for all of us, it's just like support Ukraine, support Ukraine, support Ukraine, till actually Ukraine wins. I mean, until at the end of the day, Putin lose. And I think the proof is just like, of course, the question will be in the long term, when the war will be over. And it means when the war will be over, it means that at the terms that the Ukrainian will define. And then we'll see. But I think diplomacy will play its role then afterwards.
Now we can talk about China. I just wanted to get that in, because Ulrich, I noticed your hand went up as soon as China was mentioned. And I do know that as united as Europe and the U.S. has been in regards to Ukraine, China is a bit more complicated. Your comments to that?
Yeah, maybe just to follow up on what Ambassador Leventhal said. I mean, there are some differences in nuances on how the EU and how the US approaches China. Things that I don't think we can do away with. I mean, US is, and we should support the US in their fight to stay the prominent or the dominant power in the world. We'd rather see US on that position than China. EU is not really a contender, right? That's number one. Number two is, I'm sorry, I know it sounds wrong in Paris, but that's the way it is, a little bit for a decade maybe. Secondly, I mean, the European economy is much more exposed to Chinese trade and investment than the US. I think about perhaps twice as exposed. There's also more at stake economically for Europe. And the last thing is that the US is a legitimate Pacific power. The US has legitimate interest in the Pacific. The EU, less so, right? We're not a Pacific. Yes, I know you have a few ships out there. But we're not exactly, I mean, the rest of us are not exactly bordering the Pacific. What I'm trying to get at here is that there are some systemic structural issues why it's absolutely natural for the US to be more concerned about China than Europe. And that should not take away from the fact that we need transatlantic alignment on China. This is so defining for the way we are going to defend our values. And I said it yesterday, and I'd like to repeat it again today, that had it not been for US leadership when it comes to defending democracy, freedom, rule of law against Russian aggression in Ukraine, I don't think Europe is politically mature enough yet to have handled this on our own, even though this is a crisis on our own soil. We are working on it. Paris is leading the European effort to work on it. Denmark, we just chatted about it. Denmark is actually beginning to join that European ambition for the whole of the continent. But we could not have pulled this off without the US extremely, extremely clever diplomacy by the Biden administration, forging a transatlantic alliance, but also bringing in Australia, Japan, Korea, and so on. We still have some work to do to get the rest of the world on board, the rest of the democracies, Brazil, Indonesia, India. They are not exactly joining our sanctions regime, sometimes the opposite. So we have some work to do together.
I think you deserve both some French wine and a chance to reply to Oleg.
I mean, first of all, I mean, I totally disagree with what you say. It's just like Europe doesn't have interests or more legitimate interests than US in Pacific. We bloody are the country in Pacific because of France, who have the biggest economic exclusive zone in the Pacific. That's the first thing. And it's not because actually Denmark doesn't have actually these small islands that actually you don't have an interest. Ask Maersk or DSV, all your company whose ship are going through the straits and whose economy is depending on actually the free passage on this and the economy. We do have bloody huge interest in this area. And this is actually why the EU has Indo-Pacific kind of policy and strategy. So, but I do agree with you that we have a different way of seeing the relation with China. The Commission, European Commission, says that we have to do three things at the same time, and that's a problem, with the same people and do it at the same time, which is basically to cooperate with China on global issues like global warming, fight against fight for environment and biodiversity. The second thing is just like we have to fight with China because it's a competitor on the economic fields using actually all kind of methods that are not right. So we need to have level playing field, protect our strategic assets from China, and that's the things. And the third thing that we have to do is basically to fight against China because they have a different view. It's a systemic rival on the international scene and the international order. And we have to do the three things at the same time. So that's why it's actually sometimes difficult. But on the same time, it's, and this is something that is also important, we do not have like in-between positions between China and the US. We are, of course, much more on the side of the US. We do share US concerns. We do understand what is at stake. So we are allies. And so it's, but it is important maybe for the other countries that are the so-called global south, because I hate the word, but doesn't represent anything. But actually, this country might not be able to just get into a two confrontational things between China and the US. They might need another way to deal with. And then this is actually what the Europe in general can provide, a little bit of an alternative that is complementary to the US approach.
But is it complementary? Do I hear you asking the EU to be a bit more aggressive when it comes to China? Or is our strategy just very different from the American?
I don't think it's totally different from the America, but I think we need to be more assertive. I mean, as European, we've been too naive. I mean, our markets were totally open. I mean, our public tender are just open and a Chinese company just can come and just like bid for something, build a nice, autoroute highway in Montenegro, for example, or Poland, just to mention a few. And then it's not the same in China. It's not reciprocal. So we have to be less naive.
When I was in Washington with the Prime Minister, it was a terrific meeting with the President in the Oval Office and a very warm relationship. And everyone for Denmark should be proud of the relationship that the Prime, seeing the Prime Minister with the President and the strength and the depth of our relationship. We also went up to Capitol Hill, and there were Democrats and Republicans there on Capitol Hill. And I have to tell you, there is continues to be strong support for Ukraine. But I also have a concern, and I heard this voiced, that over time, Americans are going to ask, are NATO members in Europe meeting or exceeding their 2% commitment? Americans are willing to do their part and take a lead. But in order to continue to have that type of support, it's imperative that European NATO members meet or exceed the 2%. And I just want to reinforce that, because that came through that we're going to see that over time.
Ambassador Perso, I thought you were both smiling and nodding at the Ambassador Leventhal's point on the defense budgets. Are you satisfied with the development now that we've taken in Europe in regards to defense budgets? I mean, Germany, Denmark as well, other European countries. Is it enough? Is it a direction or...
Well, at least it's a good start. Mm-hmm. I think France is one of the countries who already said, like, since ages, like, we should spend more on defense and security. So we can only be happy that actually this wake-up call, because of the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, or because actually our American allies clearly say since some years that actually there is a burden sharing, and then actually the EU has to take part of the burden. And there's actually, my answer is that no problem, we'll do it. The European pillar of NATO will be reinforced, and actually we will do it collectively, be it at EU level or at European pillar of NATO. And that's good. And if you see in the last few years, I mean, think about the fact, like, what, 5-10 years ago, if you had anyone telling you that actually the European Commission or the European budget will put money into defense and defense capacity, I mean, first, I will have been shot in Paris, because they didn't want actually the EU to touch anything that was serious, which is like, you know, war and defense. And on the contrary, and in Brussels, people are just like, hey, you're mad, you're the French guy who actually wants actually the EU to spend money on it. And in fact, now you have the European Defense Fund, which is 7 billion euro. That's a start. And I think in the next, certainly, multi-annual framework, financial framework, there will be more money. I mean, the European Peace Facility, we're talking about Ukraine and what we've done. I remember the negotiation we had. It was hugely difficult to just get some countries, and I will not name them, to just like put money on the European Peace Facility, because we wanted to have the capacity to finance weapon into it. You know, oof, that's bad. And then this is the same country that now are using this peace facility to give, I mean, armory, ammunitions to Ukraine. So we are on the right track, and we'll continue on this.
We talk a lot about the EU today. We talk a lot about NATO, good relationships, everyone stepping up. Or like when we spoke a couple of days ago, you had this very interesting analysis that we've been really good at uniting in Europe, really good at uniting in NATO, but the rest of the world are kind of not following us anymore.
No, there was a poll made a couple of months ago that came out under the heading United West Divided from the Rest. And of course, that's an exaggeration, but it has the truth to it that in the West, we are perhaps more cohesive. There's more togetherness in the West than there has been for three decades, I would say, at least my diplomatic life. But if you look at the rest of the world, they're not overly impressed with us. They do not think that we always, you know, follow our own morale and our own, you know, values. And I think it's worth noting, as I said earlier today, two Asian countries, zero African countries, zero Latin American countries have joined our sanctions against Russia. We need to ask ourselves the question, why is it that the Western democratic values that we are sort of trying to defend here, why are we not able to bring Brazil, Indonesia, India, South Africa, and a lot of other African and Latin American countries behind us in that quest? I think some of the answer lies in the fact that they are also afraid of China. 120 countries in the world have China as their biggest trading partner. I agree, many of them are small Pacific island states, but still 120 countries. So, of course, they're hedging their bets a little bit, right? And I mean, India somehow manages to have super relations with the US. They're also part of the Shanghai Corporation. They're part of the Quad. They're hedging their bets because they don't know where this world order is headed. We need to bring him on our side. They're reluctant to do so, but there are also things that we can do in terms of consistency of our own foreign policy.
Ambassador Leventhal, since we're not discussing the IRA, are you nodding at Ulrich and agreeing with the UN, other larger organizations? We've left them behind. We've left the continent of Africa behind. We've kind of closed around ourselves, which has been great for NATO, great for the EU, great for the alliance between the EU and the US. But do you share the analysis?
I think we recognize in particular that we have to involve the global south. And there are efforts to involve the global south, and that's going to be critical. I want to come back to talking about Russia. You know, there's a lot of discussion in peace overtures. Russia is the sole obstacle to peace. The war would be over tomorrow if Russia just withdrew. And the United States position is that we want a democratic, independent, sovereign, and prosperous Ukraine, and in a position to defer and defend itself against future aggression. I don't think we should lose sight of that simple message about how this war could be over tomorrow and what our goals are.
And unfortunately, we're beginning to run out of time here, but I want to give you, you got an easy question when we started, so now I'm going to give you
a difficult one, yes.
Because I want to ask you, and it's in regards to what Ambassador Leventhal is saying, is there room for negotiation, or are we way past that? And if that is the case, how will the world look from your perspective, that being the US, France, OECD, and Denmark, in 5 years? Ambassador Perisseau first, please.
There's always a room for negotiation, but for negotiating, there's actually prerequisite. And actually, these prerequisites for the time being are absolutely not met. And what Alan said just right there, Russia can end the war immediately if they want to. And so the prerequisite is just like retrieve from Ukrainian territory, stop the war, stop actually violating international norms, and then actually we will maybe able to discuss. And that's the thing. So how the world will look in 5 years? Well, hopefully the war will be over with a win of Ukraine and a lose from Putin. That will be the same things. It means that we might have a chance to have a new security architecture within Europe. If we are optimistic, I think we will be able to have a different relations with third countries outside Europe or Western world, I would say, based more on an equal partnership, based on a mutual reinforcement of sovereignty. When we talk about sovereignty in Europe, it's not limited sovereignty like some people in Russia think about it in some ages. So, and hopefully also, because this was also the elephant in the room with China, we will find a way actually to deal with China. I mean, stop the intrusive and not playing fair, and at the same time still cooperating on some issues. So I'm an optimistic one.
Oh, like I'm going to twist your question a bit, because I would like you to answer the question, but here in regard to, is there room for negotiating the sanctions?
No, I don't see that in any foreseeable future. It's really quite simple. If Russia withdraws, there will be peace. If Ukraine withdraws, there'll be no Ukraine. I mean, that is basically where we're at, right? Is there room for negotiation? I don't see it right now. There are you know, four factors playing together at the moment, which make for a quite, at least for me, pessimistic view of this conflict, not surprising. One is Ukraine thinks they can win. Russia thinks they can win. Ukraine can't win. Russia can't win. Those four go together for a long war because as long as both sides think that they're capable of winning, but it's actually not the case, I really do fear that we're looking into 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years where the front lines maybe move a little bit, but as long as both sides think they're winning and they're not satisfied with the status quo and they can't, then we have the recipe for a very long conflict. I know that there are more hopeful analysts, maybe also among us here on stage, there are people who are really hopeful that Ukraine can win. And this is maybe the only time at the people's meeting here in Bornholm where I'll say, I hope I'm not right.
Tak fordi du lyttede med på Altingets Europa-podcast i den her uge, som altså var en lettere redigeret optagelse af en debat under folkemødet på Bornholm i juni. Den her var organiseret af Pension Danmark. Debatten var modereret af journalisten Josefine Kofod fra TV2. News. Med i panelet var to ambassadører i Danmark, amerikanske Alan Leventhal og Frankrigs Christophe Parisot, OECD's vicegeneralsekretær Ulrik Vestergaard Knudsen og så Torben Møger Pedersen, administrerende direktør for Pension Danmark. Mit navn er Thomas Lauritsen. Tak for i dag. Lyt med igen næste uge, lige her, hvor Altinget taler om Europa.